All right, it is Tuesday, December 30th, 2025. This is our pre-New Year's Eve, our New Year's Eve gathering this year. And other years since we've been doing this, since March of 2025, 2020, sorry, blah blah. We have landed on significant days, and I think if it landed on New Year's Day or New Year's Eve or Christmas or something, we would just show up. I would show up if you guys did. That's up to you. But I find it kind of a joy to just be here no matter what. So far, maybe if the power weren't on, I wouldn't be able to. Like, I guess I'd try to use my phone, but it's a point of pride, I'll say, for which I have to mention, like, next, one of my other points of pride is trying to show up on the second Tuesday at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. And next month, we are exchanging our house with someone in New York. And I actually made arrangements so that I could still be in Berkeley for that day. It won't always be this way, but it is right now. So we're going to start, as usual, with a period of meditation, after which a Dharma topic will hopefully emerge. So let us settle into whatever is a comfortable and supportive posture for your own practice. And coming into stillness. Can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And beginning by just tuning in to how you're feeling right now. The word feeling, of course, can refer to different things. It could be just how your body feels, the sensations, but it's also our mood or general mind state. Now you choose. What do you want to pay attention to? Maybe touching into each of these. It's very helpful to bring awareness to the body, to just feel the sensations in the body, feel the body as a grounded, stable. And our mood or our mental state, though, is also something that winds up determining a lot of our thoughts, a lot of what emerges as we meditate. And so it can be helpful just to acknowledge that we're bringing that into this experience, into this practice. And once you've kind of surveyed these feelings for yourself, to start to focus on the breath as a concentration object, as a kind of place to ground the attention. Feeling the sensations of an in-breath, sensations of an out-breath. And that gives us a way of bringing awareness to the sensations that are quite subtle. But the distinction between the in-breath and the out-breath highlights the sensations for us. The subtlety of the breath encourages a subtlety of attention. We have to look closely . Can you stay with the whole breath, the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath? What interrupts that attention? We see how quickly the mind wanders, the mind jumps into the stream of thinking. And so our practice is to keep coming back to the breath. The Buddha calls this training the mind. The mind tends to be quite unruly. We're trying to train it so that we can point the attention toward more wholesome, more useful places of focus. But before we accomplish that, we'll get to see the many digressions and diversions that the mind chases down. Observing these thought patterns can also be quite revealing. Where does our mind tend to go? What are the themes or obsessions that capture, pull it about? And in seeing these unwholesome habits of mind, how do we handle them? How do we react? Does judgment arise? Self-criticism? Can we let go of that as well? Bring kindness, acceptance to this mind, which is so difficult, so challenging to be with. Mind isn't supposed to be any particular way. The Buddha tells us that the underlying impulses of mind are driven by greed, hatred, delusion. So we can't expect to find anything else in those impulses. We can only work with what is. Bring mindfulness, bring compassion, forgiveness. And whenever we remember, or whenever we notice, guide the attention back to the present moment. This takes great patience, determination. All right. Very good. Good morning again. Just for those who might not be familiar with the approach I take to these guided meditations, my general philosophy is talk for a while and then stop. Rather than kind of stretching it out through the whole sitting, I like to give people just some quiet time. Because I know some people don't want to be talked to the whole time. And I also think it's valuable, to sit in silence. People sometimes ask me, is it okay to listen to guided meditations? I'm like, of course it's okay. Just notice what happens. But, at the end of the day, we are dependent upon our own, powers of attention. And it's good to become, depend or independent in that regard, I think. Kind of came up for me that it might be helpful to talk about concentration today, not particularly seasonally related, but a topic that comes up a lot and is often the underlying question in people's questions about meditation, particularly when they're asking, like, how do I stop thinking so much? So I think the first thing to me, maybe I'll take you sort of through what I consider sort of stages or a process, which is that the first thing is to not expect to be concentrated. I think there's, when we hear the meditation instructions, particularly kind of traditional ones, avoid them somewhat, but, just when your mind wanders, come back to your breath, there is this subtle implication that you're not supposed to be thinking. And so very often people get the idea that, oh, my mind is wandering and so I'm not doing it right, or I'm failing, or this isn't working. And so instead of just noticing, oh, my mind was wandering, or this is where it was wandering, this is what it was doing, there a secondary kind of response comes up, a reaction, a judgment, a self-judgment, and that, instead of helping, really hinders the process. If we sort of the if we accept that most thoughts, as I said during the meditation, are driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. Let's just say that desire or a wish for things to be different from the way they are, with that kind of projection of the mind, then thinking about those thoughts or judging those thoughts is just another form of, wanting things to be different. It's aver typically we'd call that aversion in the traditional language, desire and aversion, these kind of two hindrances. And we don't delusion isn't one of the hindrances, but it could be. So what we see is that when we react to our thinking in a negative way, in a judgmental way, or a frustrated way, we're just compounding the issue, right? So the first thing that we have to do in order to develop concentration is to not judge our lack of concentration. And that's a big step, actually, in meditation. We could say it in recovery terms, it's about acceptance, accepting this is what's happening right now. And since what we're trying to practice is mindfulness, which is just awareness, essentially, then when we say, oh, my mind is wandering, it's, going off into fantasies or resentments or judgments, then we're just being mindful of what's arising. And that's, so you're already doing a good job when you see that. That's already success, even though it might not feel good. And that's what's kind of going on here. Certainly one of the things that's going on here, which is that when you're sitting and just trying to chill and just trying to meditate, and the mind is going all over the place, it doesn't really feel good. It's kind of unpleasant. And so what's happening actually is you're experiencing exactly what the Buddha taught, which is that there is this thing, this that we call dukkha. It's this kind of agitation, this underlying dissatisfaction with things. And again, when we can, instead of fighting with that, just see it and understand it, then we're having insight. We're seeing, oh, like what the Buddha taught is actually true. So already, I think what I'm showing unintentionally, but just by talking about the Dharma, it reveals itself, is that the process of developing concentration isn't one of rushing toward concentration or trying to grab hold of concentration. It starts with this non-resistance, this non, what the Buddha would call non-ill will. So non-ill will toward the present moment state, which might be unpleasant. So this is, a critical piece of meditation as well as recovery, which is, can I just accept that things aren't quite the way I'd like them to be? Because addiction and alcoholism is this non-acceptance, this I'm going to change it, I'm going to fix it, I want to feel this way. It's not okay to feel this way. I can't handle it. And so we're building this inner strength, this inner resilience of, yeah, that's kind of not ideal, but we learn to just sort of say, yeah, but it's okay. There I was looking at some suttas yesterday where the Buddha, before he becomes enlightened, and he's like trying to control his meditation, and he says he's crushing mind with mind. And it's like it really doesn't generally work very well to try to crush mind with mind. And so when if we can sustain this non-resistance and this mindfulness of what's happening, there's a natural settling that starts to happen. And it mostly manifests in the nervous system, something I've been talking about a lot, in the body, energetically, rather than all of a sudden my mind just locks in on the breath or everything just stops and I'm just sitting in emptiness and stillness. That's, a potential place to get to, but what tends to happen first is that because we are in this attitude of non-resistance, which also means non-fear, then the nervous system gets deactivated. So much of the time when we sit down to meditate, we realize that our nervous system is slightly jacked up, So interesting. I mean, the science of it, I don't know a great deal about. But, we know that there are these, the fight, flight, freeze tendencies, the triggering of the amygdala, And you would think, well, I'm just sitting here doing nothing. Why would I being, feel like that, But there's this, I think baseline of alertness, that most people seem to carry. That, Wes Nusker would talk about this, where I first really heard him talk about this idea that the humans, the early humans who were too relaxed, got, died, were killed, they were killed off. Their DNA did not survive because they weren't careful enough. But the very nervous people, the very anxious people who were always looking out for dangers, stayed safe, and their DNA survived. There's a logic to that. I don't know if it's, proven out in science, but it certainly makes sense that so that we are the inheritors of that, fear that the saber-toothed tiger is right behind the next bush, and we've got to watch out. And so even when we're sitting here, in these what we consider to be safe places, there's a part of us that's on alert, that's watching out. And as we sit still, after a while, you eventually can get kind of tuned into that and feel that, like this core, like anxiety. I hope I'm not just talking about myself. I don't think I am. And that, to a large degree, that can get deactivated just through this process of non-reactivity and continuing to come back, training the mind to come back to the present moment, to the just experiences that are actually happening rather than the ones that are in the mind that we're projecting. What's actually happening is I'm sitting here and I'm doing nothing and I'm trying to turn my attention to my breath. And then I connect with my breath and then I'm just breathing. I'm just aware of that. And so this is how what we call concentration develops. Now, you may already be able to see that the word concentration doesn't quite capture what I'm describing. Concentration in the English language, as I understand it, suggests a one-pointedness, just being focused on one thing and blocking out everything else. And when we talk about sitting and just having the nervous system be deactivated, but the mind is still kind of plodding along and generating thoughts, that doesn't, and we're feeling the breath, but we're not just feeling the breath. We're not, zeroed in on the precise sensations of in-breath, out-breath. It doesn't sound like concentration. So, we have the term samadhi, which, sometimes I prefer to use a Pali term or Sanskrit term, so that we can define it for ourselves, rather than be sort of influenced by that our conditioned understanding of an English term. Nonetheless, if I'm talking about this process, as the nervous system becomes deactivated, it becomes easier then to actually stay with the breath. To actually, oh, now, because there's less busyness, there isn't the fogginess of mind, there isn't the edginess of it. And now we continue then, if we are trying to develop concentration, we continue to go, okay, let me see if I can how the breath is now. And here we can start to apply some of the forms of right effort that allow this to deepen. And so what we try to do with the breath as a concentration object now is to start to feel it in more detail, not just aware of it in breath and out breath, but to start to feel the beginning of the in breath and feel the whole flow of the in breath. Notice the moment of turning around to the out breath, the beginning of the out breath, the whole flow of the out breath, the end of the out breath. And we start to see, oh, the breath is many things. It's got all these different elements. And if I'm able to stay with it, if the mind has become stabilized enough, then I start to experience much more with the breath. Now, hand in hand, as we do this, this naturally means that there's more concentration, more clarity, more stillness. So in a way, we can say the concentration is the side effect or the it's not that we're trying to concentrate as much as we're just following these instructions and letting them unfold, letting the results unfold. Now, I think it's useful to point out that, well, let me just go back a little bit and say that as this starts to happen, as we start to get more quiet, and things really start to calm down. There's a pleasant feeling that comes with that, right? There's a great relief. It's like that first drink, that first time you get high, for some people it's, heroin, opiates. Other people it's, benzos, that just peaceful feeling of the Valium coming on. We're smoking a joint, just settling in. Sorry, hope I'm not activating anybody here. But this happens in the meditation that, like, oh, this is nice. And there can be. And I will say, I had this experience when this first happened for me that I thought, oh, now I'm getting, not only am I getting somewhere, but this is where I'm trying to get to. This is what this is about. And that's not true. However, because it's very pleasant, and because you've kind of been going through this process, and this is where you've arrived, it's not unnatural that you have this thought or this sense that, oh, now it's starting to work. This is what meditation is supposed to be about. And it's not that meditation isn't supposed to be about having a pleasant experience. It's just that that's not the primary purpose, right? That what we're trying to develop is wisdom. Concentration can aid in developing wisdom, but as I talked about in the beginning stages, we can develop quite a bit of wisdom just by seeing how crazy our mind is. Now, that's, as I've said, not pleasant to watch our crazy mind, but it's very educational. And it can help us with our perspective toward our crazy mind, toward other people's crazy minds, toward the crazy world. See, oh, greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay. So that insight begins before the concentration develops to any degree. And the point is to continue looking at what's being revealed. What can you learn from what's happening right now? Rather than, oh, now I'm there. Let me just hang out here. We have this image again. I've been kind of going through some suttas this past week, and there's the moment when the Buddha becomes enlightened, and he says, I don't really need to do anything now. I've finished my work, and I don't really want to bother to teach because that'll just be, as he says, wearying, because people are going to be like, what do you mean there is no self? And they're not going to understand. What do you mean dependent originate? What is all this stuff? What do you mean suffering is caused by craving? And he's like, I just hang out, I got mine. And then in the sutta, there's this, magical thing that happens. A Brahma god who can read the Buddha's mind apparently goes like, oh no, the world will be lost because the Buddha's teaching will not be shared. And so he comes down, come on, you got to teach. There's some people that'll get it. And the Buddha's like, oh, okay, I guess you're right. But what, like us, when we get very concentrated, we can kind of feel like, well, this is enough. Like, I can just hang out and be concentrated. We're not maybe going to go out and become world teachers, but we become our own teachers if we stay alert, keep watching. What is there to be understood about this experience? And nonetheless, I'm talking about concentration. So, the point of that is that when we get to a state like this, we can become very attached to it. And this is quite common. And I would say probably more common with addicts because we're addicts. So what do you expect of us? And you particularly see this in retreat settings, that people who have these experiences and these concentration experiences can get deeper and deeper and more pleasant. People, become so attached to that that they view retreats as the kind of purpose almost of their lives. The center of their lives become going on retreat. And you'll hear people say things like, I need a retreat. That to me is a bit of a sign. I mean, we all can benefit at any time from retreat. So I don't blame someone for who's feeling, life is, throwing everything at them that it does, feeling like, oh, I'd really love to get on a retreat. But when it's because their concentration is slipping, my meditation is really getting bad, I need a retreat. That's kind of a sign. And I mean, I say this particularly because I was on a long retreat. Now it's 2 years ago, and at the end of the retreat, had a meeting, recovery meeting, and several of the people who shared were clearly people who were using retreats as a way to avoid drinking and using. Like when they were off retreat, they were, acting out on their addiction. So their only way of not drinking and using was to sit for, 6 weeks or whatever. Anyway. I'll talk a little bit more about concentration. When the nervous system gets deactivated, and then the attention gathers very strongly around the breath or around sound or around sensations. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be the breath. That's just a common object we use. But the mind gets very focused on one thing. Then we develop the potential to move into these deeper states called jhana, which are absorption states. And there are altered states of consciousness that are accessible to us, particularly through meditation. Although sometimes people fall into them spontaneously, not very commonly. But these states are in traditional Theravadin Buddhism are considered right concentration. And yet, we see that in the two major texts on meditation in the Theravadin tradition, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, the jhanas are never mentioned. And so there's been a debate for thousands of years, in fact, frankly, going back to the time of the Buddha or shortly after, about whether jhanas are necessary for enlightenment or not. Now, I don't know if how many of you are striving for enlightenment in the traditional, in the classic sense, Buddhist teachings. But it becomes quite interesting because here again, it's about our, as we think about these teachings, about, oh, you mean there's another state I can get into that's even more deep? Oh, what do I have to do to get there? And so there's a lot of attachment comes up around these states. And you know, when they're described as these different, you know, rapture and equanimity and the realms of emptiness and realms of infinite consciousness and things, they just sound very alluring. And again, it's very easy to, if we do get access to these states, to think, oh, now I've got this. So, you know, it's almost like your meditation resume. You know, oh, well, you know, what jhana have you gotten to? You know, I mean, literally, I've had conversations like this with people. I'm like, what are we doing here? And once again, it's like, you're just not quite aiming in the right direction. Like, yes, if you can develop that and cultivate it, great. What are you doing with it? And the problem with jhanas, particularly for lay people who only have limited amount of time to practice, is that it takes so much time and effort to develop the jhana that there's very little time left to just be mindful. Or just, or cultivate insight. So there's tendency, oh, like, okay, I went on a 1 month retreat, and for the first 27 days, I worked at developing the third jhana. And then at the end, I noticed that there was a lot of grasping, and I was really pissed off at this person who was breathing next to me. But because I was so concentrated, I didn't notice it until I stopped focusing on the jhana. The very common things that we block everything out, but the mind is still doing stuff. And because we're not allowing ourselves to pay attention to it, because we're kind of crushing mind with mind, we're missing this bigger picture. This is why I really encourage open awareness. Trying to, you know, yes, you have a general focal point, whether it's breath or body or energies, feelings. But then there's like you're catching the stuff that's showing up. You're seeing, oh, look, you know, I'm drifting. And oh, like, I mean, literally, this has happened to me when I was working on concentration that I didn't realize until the end of like a 2 week retreat that I was pissed off the whole time at somebody in the on the retreat because I was blocking it out, you know. And so this is the risk of concentration. Yes, it allows a deep peace and potentially opens for insight. But in those states, it's very difficult to have insight. So you have to, it's kind of like you dive in, you go down deep, and then you come back gradually, just, okay, Now I'm still settled, but now I'm alert. Now I'm watching. Now I'm seeing things. And that's a very delicate dance. And as I say, it takes quite a bit of time. And, probably more efficient for a monastic who's going on 3 month retreats every year than it is for a lay person. Well, I talked a lot about concentration there and used up a lot of time. So I'm not in a hurry to go anywhere right now. So if people need to leave, I understand that. We have a few minutes left before 11 o'clock Pacific. But I will hang out if there are questions and people have or comments, please. I will say before, it seems like an appropriate moment to mention this that I'm just looking at the chat and how, very kindly Monica puts in information and just that I know there's a bunch of you that regularly give me Donna, and it's very kind and very sweet, and it's appreciated. I don't talk about it a lot, but I notice it because it's like, oh, you got a Venmo or you got a Zelle or whatever it's called, Zelle. I call it Zelly, but anyway, and sometimes people send me checks, they get my address, and so it's very sweet and helpful, and not insignificant to me that that this builds up. So thank you all for that ongoing support. And there is no expectation here, no demand. Monica, I see you have your little hand up.
Right, and I was trying to find it because I heard this podcast with Dan Harris. Oh, and her name is, let me look her up again. I couldn't find the podcast, but her name is Amisha Jha, Dr. Amisha Jha, and she studies human attention span somehow,
Oh, gosh.
and so it's only 7 seconds.
Yes.
So there is science backing this up from and again, I just like Wes would have said, but that if you didn't pay attention frequently, you could be eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. So it kind of goes back, they do reference it going back to ancient times. So that doesn't explain. So if you've can concentrate for 7 seconds and then you have to think about something. And now you know there's science. So there's your science for today. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
New York Times has abandoned science because,
Oh.
anyway. Gee, usually when I talk about concentration, a lot of people want to say something. Anne Peruzzi, perfect. Hello.
I'll be honest. So when you said that, topic is concentration, a little piece of me went, oh. It's funny. It's funny. I mean, just a very subtle, you know what I mean?
Like, I don't want to think about this. I don't want to hear about this.
Well, not that I don't want to hear about it because I always hear something wonderful, but I think it comes from, what does it come from? Oh, like all my efforting for the first several years, maybe. That's where it comes from. And now I see it in a bigger context now, right? And with all those studies and practice and stuff and going on a long retreat, which that's another story. And well, I actually want to talk to you about that. But anyway, that was a while ago, but it's coming up. And so what I like the last couple of weeks, I've been really focusing on metta practice, both phrases and radiating, both, and it's a concentrate, it's taught as a concentration practice. And
Sure.
so the phrases and well also, yeah, well anyway, and it's been a really for 2 weeks, just during this whole period of time before solstice, during and then now this period. My family, my kids are home now for like 10 days, and boy, it really highlights. It's lovely though. I mean, I feel like I've anyway, this the, I had this I was fortunate. I was able to go on a like a retreat workshop at Esalen, which I hadn't ever done, because I always thought that, oh, I go to Spirit Rock, that's my retreat time, you know, for 20 whatever years or more. So, but I finally went because one of my a friend of mine and person I respect a lot was teaching a workshop. And what came up for me, I don't know why this is coming up for me now, but my kids are home. So we did a death contemplation, you know, lying down, and he guided us through this really interesting. And then we were instructed to write after, you know, sort of stream of consciousness. And what really strongly, even in the contemplation, what really came up for me was, I really want to ask for forgiveness to my kids, like for anything I've done to shame them or make them feel less than, right? And I mean, this is all a result of practice. I you know, where else is this going to come from? It's not coming from should, it's coming from a genuine like. So that will happen sometime at the right time. But anyway, metta, I just wanted to put a plug in for metta as a way to soothe the nervous system, you know. And yeah, and I always, you know, I haven't chimed in as much recently, and I feel like, yeah, I love you all and love you and
Good to see you.
well, it's good to
I, just in terms of concentration, not to, because
No,
obviously you said a
please.
lot that's very touching and moving, and definitely I know many of us have questions about resolving things maybe with our children or generational stuff. But what immediately I thought of when you brought up metta was like how I can't stand doing metta phrases anymore. And that it's really important to find an object of concentration that works for you. And for some people at some times, because for me at some times I was able to do that. And when my daughter was an infant and a toddler, and I would go on retreat, I would have explosive metta, like incredible metta. And now, she's a grown up, and what do you think? But, and there were times when I was more able to just like really focus on my breath. Nowadays, I most fo more focus on the energy in my body, and I talk about that a lot. But it's important for each of us to find what works for us. And it's great to like experiment, listen to different teachers, listen to different guided meditations, and find something that works for you. There isn't a right or a wrong thing to do. People repeat mantras, that can be very effective. Chanting. Some people say, oh, running is my meditation. It's not quite the same concentration, but whatever is working for you. As I mentioned a lot, my wife, swims in the bay every day, and I know that for her, that's the thing that deactivates her nervous system, if you will, or whatever energizes her in the way she needs to be energized.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, and one more thing. Since Monica mentioned Dan Harris, you did a wonderful interview with him on loving kindness, living kindness.
Living kindness,
Yeah,
right?
check it out.
Thank you. Good plug. Vicky.
Hi, hi. Nice to
Hi.
hear you and Anne and others. Yeah, so Happy New Year almost.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah.
If we make it.
So my sense is that as I've experienced some concentration, it helps me detach from the taking the thinking personally. And so, and you know what that does is it allows me to be compassionate. I mean, so when I'm sitting with
That's right.
somebody who's shaking and baking, you know, who are about to drink or about to use, you know, and they're like totally activated, I can remember what it is. Well, I can remember impermanence. I can remember that dukkha is just, dukkha happens. And it's not a big deal, right? It happened. It arises and passes, and I can be with people in a more concentrated way when when I'm practicing this, allowing the thing to pass, right? I mean, you're letting go. So all of this seems like it's very much tied into my experience of concentration, and really looking to see that what is impermanence? How does it feel? It's great.
That's very helpful, and I think, again, yes, we're hearing how the word concentration has to be understood in a very different from the ordinary way, and through and discover what it means. Like when you mentioned about it was the first thing you said, which is naturally like that's the thing I remember, right? About self, that's right. When the mind starts to quiet down, what's quieting down? The generation of I, me, and mine. That's what thoughts are. They're always expressions of self. The fewer thoughts there are, the fewer selfing there is. And I will add that what I've noticed when I was particularly working with these concentration states was that I could then apply, and I still notice it, but I can then apply right effort very strongly with tremendous determination, because there isn't selfing behind it. It's you have right intention and you have right effort. Right intention implies not that you aren't generating self. And then right effort is like abandoning the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome. And that's very hard to do when there's a lot of selfing happening, when there's a lot of thinking going on. What the effort tends to be striving. And so this is why, like, the beginning of practice is so much about non-effort, non-striving, so that we can, create that state of not selfing that then allows us to continue going deeper. And so that then we create a positive feedback loop rather than the usual negative feedback loop. So it's very interesting, because these things we're talking about, these effects, are not ones that we necessarily think of as concentration or what concentration is for. But that's really what the value of concentration is, probably mostly because it stops the generation of selfing.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
There you go. Jeez. Boom.
Boom.
We still have a couple of friends here who'd like to speak, which is great. The bio break will be calling soon, but I think we can certainly get through our two friends, Steve and Tanya. So, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, the bio break. I'll be real quick here. I can relate. I've been studying the work of Dr. Joe Dispenza now for almost 8 months to a year, and then studying Dr. Bruce Lipton's work and the science behind the meditation. And when you brought up the topic of concentration, I have to say that I've been at these deep meditations for such a long time now that I go back even before I even knew what the hell I was doing, and learn and starting to understand all these things that I'm learning through concentration, concentrating on the energy centers. And I'm finding that even with my frustration with my food addiction, that when something happens now that I know is not good for me, through the concentration, there's just these little things that are happening. Say, no, wait a minute, you shouldn't be doing this. It's kind of a strange thing. But I actually have a real deep understanding now of not self. I can remember going on retreats and asking you guys, what does that mean? What's not self? I really have to say that I understand that now. I really do. And I attribute that to the ability to concentrate now in my 2 hour meditations. And I'm just, this is my life now. My meditation practice is my life. I just love it. I can't go, there's no way I can go a day without doing my meditation. So I thank you for that and that guidance that you've been giving us.
Beautiful. Thanks, Steve. And Tanya.
Before I go, I just wanted to put in a plug for your book, Recovering Joy. I am reading it with one of my AA sponsees, and we're really getting a lot out of it. So just wanted to put in a plug there.
Thank you. It seems to be having a revival. The local recovery, dharma, what, recovery dharma, is that what it's called? Wow, my brain. Their meeting is reading it, and they actually have been buying copies of it through me. So they bought 100 copies of the book. I'm like, 100 copies. So I
That's
went down there. It's at 924 Gilman, the famous punk rock club in Berkeley, on Sunday morning. So I went down there and spoke the Sunday before last, and that was a delight. If you ever get a chance to go to 924 Gilman, it's where
I'm in
Green,
Berkeley. I certainly will.
yeah, it's where Green Day and Operation Ivy and Rancid and a lot of the great punk bands of the Bay Area started out. And so, of course, the inside of it is fantastic. It's this, graffiti gone wild place. And the meeting, a big meeting, and as might be expected, full of Berkeley and Oakland types, which feels very much at home. So anyway, thank you, Tanya. I am have difficult relationships with many of my books, so I'm glad that others are having pleasant relationships with them. But it's like you're it's not actually it's not like my children at all, but anyway, so next time we meet, it will be 2026, assuming that the world is still here. I'm still here. You're still there. And so I hope everybody avoids any intoxicants over the coming days, and finds some kind of joy in this transition into what can only be a better year than this one.
Got that right.
We've had some bad ones. I mean,
Hands down.
2020, 21, they were pretty bad, but the idea of a quarantine doesn't seem so bad now compared to anyway, the end of America. But we had a good run. So everybody, blessings. Thank you all.
Thank you, Kevin. I've been
Thank
spreading your
you.
books around to friends or coming to the retreats. It's been a good
Okay.
thing.
Thank
Happy
you.
New Year.
Happy
Thank you
New
so
Year.
much.
Very punk rock, what we're doing here.
Yes, it is very punk rock.